This episode is provided by Thomas Allgaier and Franis, based on the most relevant LinkedIn posts about cloud in calendar weeks 25 and 26. Franis has built a sovereign cloud market radar for ICT providers with weekly hot news, monthly reports, quarterly leadership presentations, and AI podcasts for field teams. You can find more info in the description.
Right, so we are jumping into some incredibly wild shifts today.
Yeah, we really are. And, you know, for this deep dive, our mission is to unpack the biggest cloud trends that have been blowing up across the professional network over the last 2 weeks.
Exactly. We're cutting through the noise, trying to give you, the listener, a real shortcut to understanding the new reality of cloud transformation, FinOps, and obviously AI.
Because honestly, if you're in the ICT and tech industry right now, you need to stay ahead of this. The old assumption that the cloud is just this, you know, cheap, infinite, borderless thing, that's completely falling apart.
Oh, absolutely falling apart. I mean, geopolitics and the raw economics of AI are basically forcing the cloud back down to earth.
Yeah. So let's start with this whole idea of digital sovereignty. Because it's rapidly moved from like a basic regulatory compliance checklist to just this massive boardroom priority.
Right. It's all about control and resilience now. And the network has been intensely focused on the stark difference between data residency and data sovereignty,
which are definitely not the same thing.
Not at all. Timo Halonen and Robin Faber have actually been really vocal about this lately. Faber even uses this term, sovereignty washing.
Sovereignty washing. Okay, I love that term. That's basically when a provider tells you your enterprise data is totally safe just because the physical server is, you know, sitting in a data center in Frankfurt or wherever.
Yeah, exactly. Which legally, well, it means very little. Mm-hmm. The core issue they're pointing to is the U.S. Cloud Act.
Right.
Because that legislation says that data access requests follow the nationality of the corporate operator, not the physical geography of the server.
Oh.
Yeah. So if an American parent company gets a court order, they are legally forced to produce that data, even if it's technically sitting in some European subsidiary's data center.
Okay, so it's basically like, it's like renting a safety deposit box at a local German bank, right? You feel totally secure walking into your neighborhood branch.
Yeah.
But the bank manager sitting in Washington, D.C. actually holds a master key to your box, and they don't even have to tell you when they open it.
That is the exact analogy. And it captures the exact risk profile that's, you know, keeping executives awake at night.
I can imagine.
So Devin Tysetter actually analyzed how the market is responding to this. He noted that genuinely sovereign options do exist now, like the AWS European Sovereign Cloud.
Right, because that uses a totally separate EU legal entity, doesn't it?
Exactly. It uses a separate entity and relies exclusively on EU resident staff. So that structure, physically and legally, cuts the ties to U.S. jurisdiction.
But wait, Tysetter also pointed out the catch there, right?
Yeah.
Because birthing that legal fortress around your data, it's not cheap.
Oh, not at all. It comes with a premium of around 15 to 25%.
25%, that's huge.
Yeah.
And that brings up a really good pushback from Tim Raines. He was looking at the threat modeling here and asking, well, are enterprises just overreacting?
How so?
Well, he points out this mismatch. If you look at actual government data requests, they almost overwhelmingly target consumer accounts. You know, personal emails, chat histories for criminal investigations, things like that.
Oh, right.
Government subpoenas for enterprise cloud infrastructure data are statistically basically an anomaly. So he's asking, is all this just extensive compliance theater?
That's a really fair question. I mean, why blow up your IT budget by a fifth for a theoretical threat? But Uwe Geyer from Ionos offered a really good counter perspective to that.
Okay, what was his take?
He argues that true sovereignty isn't just about government surveillance. It's about full stack operational accountability, down to the bare metal. He points to standards like ISO 27001 and BSIC 5.
Okay, let's unpack those standards a bit for anyone outside the audit world. What does BSIC 5 actually do?
So BSIC 5 is this really rigorous German government standard. It goes way beyond generic cybersecurity. It dictates the entire chain of custody.
Meaning like who can actually touch the hardware.
Exactly. Who can physically touch a server, how the hardware supply chains are audited, and most importantly, who is legally accountable when an outage happens.
Ah, okay.
For highly regulated industries, think banking or healthcare, failing an audit on those operational controls can literally cost them their license to do business.
Right. So it's an existential business requirement. It's not just geopolitical paranoia. And this isn't just a European issue either.
No, definitely not.
Robert Machen and Craig McClellan were highlighting what's happening in Canada. Up there, the hyperscalers, AWS, Azure, Google, They control 85% of the market.
Wow. 85%.
Yeah. And that translates to roughly $16 billion flowing out of Canada every single year. So digital sovereignty is basically becoming an economic retention strategy for entire countries.
Which is wild.
Yeah.
And we're seeing these massive market shifts actively happening right now because of it. Capgemini just became the first SAP sovereign cloud partner, for instance.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And ELCA partnered with Microsoft Switzerland to build out a full lifecycle sovereign cloud solution. Plus, look at Volkswagen. They are moving aggressively to adopt T-Cloud so they can centralize their sovereign infrastructure across all their different car brands.
That makes a lot of sense.
Mm.
But here's the thing. If enterprises are suddenly willing to pay these massive, 20% premiums just for sovereignty, how on earth are they managing the overall explosion in cloud costs?
Right, especially with AI thrown into the mix now.
Exactly. Generative AI is just eating everyone's budgets alive. So how does FinOps even work in this environment?
Well, it's funny you ask, because FinOps is going through a total overhaul. Ronak Goyal recently shared some takeaways from the FinOps X 2026 event, and people were jokingly calling the whole conference Tokenomicon.
Tokenomicon. That is incredible.
It is. Because tokens are literally their own financial discipline now. GenAI models caused this massive token panic this year. Organizations were hitting their full-year cloud forecasts by June.
June. That's insane. So basically, runaway AI agents are the new runaway Lambda functions.
Pretty much. Which is why Yuri Eliyahu's recent breakdown is so brilliant. He mapped traditional FinOps directly to this new GenAI world. The matrix has just completely shifted.
Okay, break that down for me. How does the old playbook apply to tokens?
Well, think about traditional compute, like CPU and RAM.
Yeah.
You used to optimize by right-sizing your virtual machines, right?
Right, so you aren't paying for idle capacity.
Exactly. Well, today, compute is input or prompt tokens, so engineers have to right-size their payloads. Instead of sending these huge bloated system instructions, you have to tightly trim the context window so you don't overpay.
That makes total sense. Okay, what about storage? Usually you'd move cold data to a cheaper storage tier.
Right, well, in AI, storage translates to output tokens and model tiering. So you shift simple routine tasks to small language models, SLMs, instead of running everything through your expensive premium tier LLM.
Oh, I see. You tier the intelligence just like you used to tier hard drives.
Exactly.
Okay, so that leaves the network layer. I think he mapped that to prompt caching, right? Let's definitely explain that because I found it fascinating.
Yeah, it's a huge deal. It bypasses this massive redundant compute tax.
So think of it like a student taking an open book exam. In the old AI model, every single time you ask a question about, say, a 500-page document, the AI reads the entire book from chapter one, answers, and then closes the book.
Right, which takes forever.
Yeah. And when you ask a follow-up question, it has to read the whole 500-page book all over again. You are paying for that reading time on every single query.
Which is just burning cash.
Exactly. But prompt caching means the AI keeps the book open on the desk. It retains the context, so it instantly drops the latency and the cost.
It's a great analogy, but here's the catch. Knowing how to optimize tokens is only part of the problem. Victor Garcia had this warning that really stood out. He noted that data platforms are now eating up to 50% of total cloud bills.
Wait, 50%? Just the data platforms?
Yes. Largely because of undetected, super inefficient queries. You know, a bad query scanning a massive database constantly. But as Ioana Yordanova pointed out, just handing a developer a spreadsheet of expensive queries doesn't fix anything.
Right, because data alone doesn't actually change developer behavior.
Exactly. FinOps is 80% culture.
So how do you fix that culture problem? Because you can't just yell at engineers to code cheaper.
Well, Yordanova suggests shifting to unit economics. So instead of just looking at raw spend, you look at cost per active user. You also gamify the optimization with leaderboards.
Make it competitive.
Yeah. But Benjamin Linares makes a great point that the ultimate fix is preventative governance. You have to catch the costs before the infrastructure is even provisioned.
Catch it in the pipeline. And actually, Loic Fournier shared an update that AWS is finally building tools for this. They rolled out these new AI-powered cost investigations and 6 new idle resource recommendations.
Oh, Loic.
Yeah, specifically for complex stuff like DynamoDB and ElastiCache. So it finds those toxic queries automatically.
That is desperately needed. Because if you combine all these massive cost pressures with the strict sovereignty requirements we talked about earlier, companies are completely rethinking where their workloads actually live.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, we are seeing a major return to bare metal hardware. David A. had some fascinating insights on this looking at the iGaming industry.
Right, the online casinos and gaming platforms.
Yeah. Their core engines run 24/7 at crazy high utilization. So paying premium public cloud prices by the minute just stops making sense. They're moving those core engines back to bare metal for predictable latency and fixed costs.
It's like deciding between owning a car or using a rideshare.
Exactly. Rideshares are great for unpredictable occasional trips. You only pay when you use it. But if you are driving 100 miles every single day, using a rideshare will bankrupt you. You need to own the hardware.
That is a perfect way to look at it.
Yeah.
And so they keep the elastic workloads in the cloud, but the heavy lifting comes home.
Exactly.
And Peter Fletcher discussed this recently, too, regarding the Private Cloud Outlook 2026 report. The big takeaway is that AI is pushing enterprises heavily toward private clouds for production workloads.
Because of the cost predictability, right?
Cost predictability and data sovereignty. Plus, Juan Carlos Flores noted this massive shift toward running on-device small language models, SLMs.
Right, pushing the compute all the way to the edge.
Exactly. Running an SLM directly on a user's phone offers zero latency, total privacy since the data never leaves the device, and it drastically lowers the central computing costs.
It's incredible, and the vendor ecosystem is scrambling to adapt to this new hybrid reality. David Tropiano announced that IBM Cloud just launched this Red Hat OpenShift virtualization service.
Okay, what does that do?
It's specifically for managing legacy VM workloads via Kubernetes, so it bridges the gap. And Harold Juice noted that German companies are basically abandoning the pure public cloud idea entirely. They are heavily favoring complex, hybrid, and multi-cloud setups now.
But wait, that brings up a huge issue. If an enterprise is running a sovereign cloud in Europe, bare metal for core apps, public cloud for elastic traffic, and local SLMs on edge devices.
A lot.
It's a massive amount of complexity. How on earth does a human IT team manage that without just completely burning out?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. And the answer is they don't, at least not alone. This is what's driving us into the agentic era of cloud operations.
The agentic era. Tell me more about that.
Hamza Chishti and Jay Shanth shared some really wild insights on this regarding Microsoft's new Azure SRE agent and their Copilot observability agent. We are shifting from assisted operations to agentic operations.
So wait, what's the difference between assisted and agentic in this context?
So assisted is like having a chatbot. A human asks it to pull logs, and the human decides what to do. Agentic means the AI acts autonomously. It diagnoses the crash, dynamically writes the query code to test its own hypothesis, and executes the workflows all by itself.
Wow.
Yeah. They are seeing this cut root cause analysis down to under 3 minutes.
Under 3 minutes. That's industry changing.
It really is. But there's a catch, which Jaroslav Panschoha observed at the recent Google Cloud Summit. He pointed out that while the tech industry has essentially solved the build side of AI,
right,
the enterprises themselves are totally overwhelmed. There's this huge delivery gap. Value is just piling up at the door because companies lack the internal operations and security frameworks to actually run these autonomous agents safely at scale.
Oh, I can totally see that. Security teams must be terrified of an agent writing and executing its own code in production.
Exactly. It's an operating model problem.
Which really ties back perfectly to a philosophy George K. Matthew shared recently. He said, and I love this quote, "Technology creates possibilities, people create outcomes, and leadership connects the two."
Oh, that is so spot on.
Right. The future of cloud isn't just about infrastructure or picking the right vendor anymore. It's about decision making. It's about setting up that preventative governance so these autonomous tools can actually be deployed safely.
Because if you don't have the leadership to connect the technology to the outcome, you just have a bunch of really expensive, complicated tools.
Exactly. It's a leadership challenge above all else.
Well, as we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final, slightly provocative thought to mull over. It builds on an idea David Eves presented, where he talked about the cloud eventually becoming a utility, kind of like the power grid.
Okay, I like where this is going.
So combine that utility concept with the rise of the autonomous AI agents we just talked about. What if the future of cloud architecture isn't about choosing a provider at all?
What do you mean?
Imagine a near future where your autonomous agentic AI acts as your company's energy grid broker. It dynamically shifts your workloads minute by minute across sovereign data centers, private bare metal, and public hyperscalers.
And it does all this routing autonomously.
Completely autonomously. based entirely on real-time token pricing, legal compliance flags, and latency needs. You never pick a vendor again. Your AI just plays the grid for you.
That is wow. That is a wild but totally plausible future to think about.
Right. It changes everything. Well, if you enjoy this episode, new episodes drop every 2 weeks. Also, check out our other editions on ICT and tech, digital products and services, artificial intelligence, sustainability and green ICT, defense tech, and health.
Thank you so much for tuning in. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss the next one.
See you on the next deep dive.